of Appeals, in and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
A very good morning to everyone. The first case for argument this morning is number 04-1615, Continental Casualty against American National Insurance. Mr. Trill.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Continental Casualty brought this action seeking a declaratory judgment against American National that it is not bound by the quota share contract, a supposed reinsurance agreement executed by IOA in an agency capacity and American National. Without any discovery or evidentiary hearing, the district court decided that Continental must arbitrate its dispute with American National, and so it granted American National's motion to dismiss. The district court had two grounds for reaching this decision. The first was that the arbitration provision in the quota share contract itself required arbitration, even though IOA was without actual authority to enter into that contract, because the district court found as a matter of law that it had apparent authority to bind Continental to that contract. In the alternative, the district court held that arbitration was required under the participation agreement. That's an agency contract between Continental and IOA, a contract to which American National is not a party. The district court concluded that American National could be considered a third-party beneficiary of that contract, and thus that arbitration could be compelled under that agreement as well. We submit that both of those theories are wrong and that the judgment should be vacated and the case remanded for further proceedings. There are two problems with the district court's determination that IOA had apparent authority. First, as a procedural matter, the court should not have undertaken to decide that factual question at all in light of the procedural posture of the case. And second, even if it was correct for the court to address that question, the record does not support a finding that IOA had apparent authority, and it certainly doesn't support a determination as a matter of law that IOA had apparent authority. Now, on the procedural front, the parties have argued back and forth about whether the motion to dismiss was a 12B6 motion or a 12B1 motion or some other kind of motion to dismiss. We continue to believe that it was properly regarded as a 12B6 motion, I think that's supported at a minimum by the district court's decision that discovery should be deferred pending resolution of the motion. And also, if you look at footnote 1 in the district court's decision, that certainly suggests that he was thinking of it as a 12B6 motion. But it ultimately doesn't really matter, because the legal standards are the same. And those standards are that the uncontested factual allegations of the complaint are to be taken as true, all reasonable inferences are to be drawn in the plaintiff's favor, and a factual issue can be resolved as a matter of law without a hearing only if there's no genuine dispute concerning that issue. So whichever way you get to the motion to dismiss, those standards are the same. And under those standards, the district court should not have proceeded as it did. Now, the question of apparent authority was raised for the first and only time in American National's reply brief in support of its motion to dismiss. To support its passing assertion that IOA had apparent authority, American National submitted an affidavit in which it asserted that it had not received notice that Continental had revoked IOA's actual authority.
Counsel, let me ask you this, and your opponent asserts this as well. The Federal Arbitration Act, does that supersede the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure?
No, I don't think it supersedes them at all. In fact, if you look at Section 4 of the Act, for example, which is the section that provides that there shall be a trial if the making of the arbitration agreement is drawn into question, it specifically says that if a jury's demanded, it shall be referred to trial in accordance with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure or such other procedures as the court may determine. So it doesn't supersede them at all. I think it's a motion to dismiss under the FAA is just like a motion to dismiss under any other statute. You bring it under, under one of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, in response to that reply brief and that affidavit in which American National asserted apparent authority, Continental argued that apparent authority is a factual issue requiring discovery. And now, just a couple of weeks before that, Continental had tried to initiate discovery. American National had resisted, saying, we don't want to proceed with discovery while our motion to dismiss is pending. We raised it with Judge Norgal, and Judge Norgal said, yeah, I think it's best to defer discovery until I decide the motion to dismiss. We also pointed out that a trial is required to resolve that issue in a case like this. Now, that was the last mention anyone made of apparent authority prior to the district court's ruling about a year later. American National's next brief said nothing about apparent authority. In fact, in particular, it didn't take issue with our contention that discovery and a trial would be required to resolve that issue. To the contrary, American National adopted a completely new theory, which was basically that the quota share contract isn't relevant at all because Continental wasn't a party to it, that arbitration was required under against the pool under the participation agreement. So apparent authority wasn't even relevant to that argument. Not surprisingly, in Continental's final brief before the district court, we didn't discuss apparent authority anymore because American National hadn't pressed the issue. So when the district court decided the apparent authority issue, and again, this is a factual issue on which American National had the burden of proof, there was no discovery, no evidentiary hearing, and nothing more than a couple of sentences in the party's briefs and this affidavit asserting that notice had not been received. So whether you look at it as a 12B1 motion, 12B6, or some sort of a motion directly under the Federal Arbitration Act, the district court should not have decided that issue on this record. Now, even if you assume that it was correct or permissible for the district court to decide the issue, it was a mistake for the court to decide it the way that it did. Apparent authority, as I said, is a factual issue, and the legal standards governing that are clear, and Illinois law applies here, I think, by agreement of the parties. Only the actions of the supposed principal, not actions of the agent, can create apparent authority. And apparent authority is found where a reasonably prudent person exercising reasonable diligence would naturally suppose, based on the principal's conduct, that the agent had authority. Under these standards, the record just doesn't support an apparent authority finding, and certainly not a ruling as a matter of law. What we have in the record here is, first of all, it's undisputed that actual authority had been expressly revoked. The revocation notice was delivered in July of 2000, effective at the end of the year, December 31, 2000. We know that in December of 2000, IOA expressly acknowledged that it had received that notice of revocation. American National, in fact, submitted that document to the court. It was 4 months later, after the effective date of the revocation and after IOA acknowledged receipt of the revocation, that it signed the quota share contract. And we also know, because the Continental alleged in its complaint and it was never refuted, the Continental was completely unaware of the quota share contract until 5 months after that, late September of 2001. The other thing we know is that IOA was and remained American National's agent, and that under IOA's separate agency agreement with American National, IOA was required to notify American National of changes in the membership of the pool. So to the extent that the district court's decision rested on the notion that Continental's participation agreement required it to give notice of its withdrawal from the pool, and that's certainly suggested at page 7 of the appendix in the court's opinion, that's just legally wrong. The agreement doesn't say that at all. So the record, as I said, has an undisputed revocation of actual authority, acknowledgement of notice of revocation by American National's agent, and American National's assertion that its agent failed to relay that notice to it. It doesn't contain any evidence of conduct by Continental, the alleged principal, that would cause a reasonably diligent person in American National's position to believe that IOA was acting on Continental's behalf in April of 2001. It certainly doesn't contain the kind of wholly one-sided evidence you'd have to see to justify a ruling as a matter of law. So we think that basis for the district court's decision just cannot stand. The alternative basis, that is that the participation agreement requires arbitration, doesn't support the district court's decision either. That agreement is between Continental and IOA. American National is not a party to that agreement, and so that agreement on its face does not provide for arbitration of any disputes between American National and Continental. Now, the district court recognized that American National was not a party to that agreement, but it declared, really without any analysis, that American National could be considered a third-party beneficiary of that contract. But under Illinois law, there's a strong presumption, as this court held in Quinn versus McGraw-Hill and other cases, a strong presumption that the parties to a contract intended to apply to them and not to third parties. to overcome that presumption, the courts require some sort of very clear evidence, such as, for example, naming the third party in the agreement or contractual provisions that could only have been intended to directly benefit that third party. That was the situation in the case that the district court cited and that American National cites in its brief, the Ross Brothers versus International Steel case, where you had a contract that provided for arbitration. It had a waiver of lien provision that the parties admitted was intended specifically to benefit a third party, American Oxide. And, in fact, American Oxide itself invoked that provision in its defense on the merits.
Although there were different participation agreements with each of the participating insurance companies, I understand they were very similar, if not identical. Is that correct?
That's certainly what the record would indicate, Your Honor.
In that case, couldn't we consider that participation agreement to be tantamount to a master agreement that simply was for the benefit, really, of all of the participants in the insurance consortium and therefore really did bestow rights upon ANI?
Well, Your Honor, I think if you look at the agreement, it doesn't bestow, accepting the fact that there was a pool and that each member of the pool had an identical or very similar agreement, if you look at the agreements themselves, and our participation agreement is the one in the record, it doesn't confer any rights on anybody other than the parties to that agreement. Now, it certainly acknowledges that there are other parties out there in a similar position, but it does not give them any rights vis-a-vis each other, any enforceable. There's no provision in the participation agreement, for example, that Continental could breach vis-a-vis American National. It could breach it vis-a-vis IOA, and that would certainly be subject to arbitration. But it does not confer any rights on pool members vis-a-vis each other. Now, the other thing I think to look at, Your Honor, is the participation agreement is an agency agreement. It doesn't create any reinsurance obligations between a pool member and any other party. This case is about a supposed reinsurance agreement between Continental and American National. Now, the fact that the participation agreement may be relevant in an evidentiary sense to the resolution of that dispute doesn't mean that this is a dispute arising out of the participation agreement.
That would be, I guess, our next inquiry. Is there any? Seems rather logical that in a participation agreement you decide how you're going to resolve disputes among all the participants to this consortium agreement.
Well, the interesting thing about this, Your Honor, is that you really won't have disputes among the pool members because it's several, not joint liability. Every pool member signed up for a specific percentage of the liability. If another pool member defaults, walks away, breaches its agreement, becomes insolvent, that has no effect on the other pool members. They're still signed up for their 5% or 10% or whatever it is. And that's why I think this is the only proper way to read the agreement is that it applies to it creates rights and obligations between the agent and the principal, in this case Continental and IOA, and provides for resolution of disputes by arbitration between those two parties. In a sense, Your Honor, this case is very similar to the iPower case, which this court decided, and in fact, I think, Judge Kaney, you wrote the opinion in that case, where you had closely related agreements, in that case a franchise agreement and an LLC agreement. One provided for arbitration, the other did not, and the court concluded that even though they were closely intertwined and the one agreement was certainly relevant to the other, you could not consider the dispute one arising out of or relating to that agreement.
You're fairly well eating into your rebuttal time, you know.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Let me make just one more point on this issue. We also, in July, we submitted a Rule 28J submission with a First Circuit decision, FitTech versus Bally Total Fitness, which is a very similar case. You had two very closely related agreements. In fact, they cross-referenced each other. A purchase agreement required execution of the employment agreements. First Circuit recognized that they were closely related, but they said that you still have to look at, you have to focus on what exactly is the dispute and which agreement does it arise under, and it did not arise under the one with the very broad arbitration provision. It was an arising out of and relating to arbitration provision. So the court did not order arbitration, and I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you,
Mr. Trella. We'll hear now from Mr. Braun.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Braun. I represent American National Insurance Company in this matter. I will probably refer to that as ANICO throughout. Your Honor, the trial court below, the district court below, reached the right decision, perhaps through no help of myself as counsel below in the briefing, but the important issue here is that the right decision was reached. And I'd like to talk first about the apparent authority grounds in the district court's opinion, and I'd like to take it in the reverse order that Mr. Trella took it. I'd like to start with what evidence the court had before it in making its decision about apparent authority, and then talk a little bit about the procedural posture at the time the court issued its decision. The court did not have the guidance of the, I believe, most recent Spear-Drake opinion from this court at the time it handed down its decision below. But what Spear-Drake says for apparent authority is you need that the principal consented to the agent's exercise of authority. Based on the actions of the agent and the principal, a third party reasonably concluded that the party was an agent and that the third party justifiably and detrimentally relied. What the district court had before it at the time it issued its decision meets all three prongs of that test. First of all, the district court had before it the participation agreement. That participation agreement was the action of the principal, here Continental Casualty, and the agent, IOA Re, on behalf of the pool, spelling out the authority. There is no question that ANICO was aware of the terms of the participation agreement, knew its terms, and could reasonably rely upon it. Moreover, the participation agreement spelled out how the agreement could be terminated and what powers and duties the various parties had up to the point of termination and thereafter. And again, ANICO was aware of those terms and could rely upon it. The district court was aware of the fact that ANICO was a party to a very similar, if not identical, agreement and had knowledge of and could rely upon those facts. The third point, then, is was it justifiable for a third party, here ANICO, to rely upon the agent's apparent authority? And we have the uncontested affidavit of Mr. Schoenweiler saying if he had known that Continental had withdrawn from the pool, he would have sought reinsurance elsewhere. That's uncontested, and quite frankly, it's perfectly logical and perfectly sane, commonsensical. We know from the record, the district court knew from the record, that only 9% of the reinsurance obligation rested in parties to the pool other than Continental and other than ANICO.
Counsel, you're referring to this affidavit. Will you explain to me again how the district court can take matters outside the pleadings and not have this converted to a Rule 56?
Your Honor, this isn't a 12B6 motion to dismiss.
Well, that's what I ask your opponent, so tell me why it's not.
Because it does not go to whether or not the complaint states a cause of action, which is what I think 12B6 goes to, and what the conversion, what the committee comments about converting a 12B6 to a Rule 56 refer to, those comments are limited to the 12B6 situation and not the other motions under 12B.
Right.
We think this is more akin to a 12B1 or some other type of 12B motion, not a 12B6 motion.
12B6 was never mentioned in your moving papers or in the court's decision.
Certainly not in our moving papers, Your Honor, and I do not believe in the district court's opinion as well. I guess, Your Honor, that sort of transitions to the second issue, which is the procedural posture of the case below. And I think it's worth noting that we filed an affidavit, we filed additional evidence in our reply brief below. Continental did not move to strike those documents, did not say they were inappropriate. What it did was ask for permission to file a rejoinder, which it was granted. It then also filed evidence outside the record in support of its subsequent pleadings. So it wasn't treating this as a 12B6 motion below either. It felt it was appropriate to go outside the four corners of the complaint, as it was. But I think it's significant that while it had the opportunity to present additional information in the form of affidavits or documents, it took advantage of that. For it to now claim that it was surprised, I think is totally disingenuous. I think it's also significant, Your Honors, that after the district court issued its opinion, Continental did not go back to the district court and ask for reconsideration. It did not say, we were unaware you were going to rule on it outside the four corners of the complaint, and had we known that, we would have presented the following evidence, the following affidavits. It did none of those things, Your Honor, to give the district court a chance to say, oh, wait a minute, maybe I'm premature here. I don't think the district court was premature. I think the participation agreement and the unopposed statements in the Schoenweiler affidavit gave the district court more than enough to reach the decisions it reached. But again, procedurally, there was nothing that Continental did that would have apprised the court below that it wanted an opportunity to either take discovery on the limited issue about the arbitration, the arbitrability of the dispute, that it needed discovery on that issue. The record that situation that Mr. Trella refers to was a 26F conference on the discovery on the case overall. At no point in that discussion did Continental's counsel advise the judge, without some discovery, we can't respond to this motion. So you either have to strike the motion or you have to allow us to have discovery. The judge was never informed of that. He had no reason to think that was true. And quite frankly, it smacks of getting two bites at the apple. Let's see how the judge rules on it, and if we lose, we'll complain that we weren't given an adequate opportunity to be heard below, and we'll ask for a second bite at the apple in that situation. Your Honor, with respect to the third-party beneficiary theory, what I believe the district court was doing and doing correctly was putting this relationship into an appropriate context. That you cannot, as Continental urged repeatedly below, look at the quota share agreement without looking at the context of the participation agreement, without looking at the context of the knowledge that Anaco had at the time of the transactions down below. I think it's reasonable to treat the participation agreement, which refers to the members and refers to duties that I think flow to the other members of the pool in terms of how you can cancel, how you can terminate, and what rights you have upon termination and what duties you have upon termination as a pool member, to find that there's a third-party beneficiary relationship there to the other pool members. But certainly it was significant in terms of the context, the relationship, the nature of the relationship, the nature of the way these people did business, and the knowledge that Anaco had at the time it entered into the quota share agreement. For these reasons, Your Honor, unless this court has other questions, we would ask this court to affirm Judge Norgal's ruling, dismissing the case and requiring the case be sent off for arbitration.
Thank you, Mr. Trella.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have a minute left, Mr. Trella.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, on the merits of the apparent authority argument, the issue is, could that be resolved as a matter of law on this record? And we submit it could not. Just one piece of evidence alone, I think, makes that impossible, and that is IOA's acknowledgement of receipt of notification of the revocation 4 months before the quota share contract was signed. On the procedural issues, I think the district court at least alluded to Rule 12b-6 in its opinion in footnote 1, where he talks about how it was okay for him to consider the participation agreement because it was referenced in the pleadings. He cites a decision of this court, which was a 12b-6 decision. And frankly, if he wasn't looking at it as a 12b-6 motion, that footnote was completely gratuitous because, as Mr. Braun pointed out, you can look at matters outside the pleadings if you're not in the 12b-6 context.
The order itself, Judge Norgal's order, does refer to 12b-3 and 12b-7 on page 3.
That's correct. It tracks American National's motion, Your Honor. Now, as far as Continental submitting evidence, the evidence that Continental submitted that Mr. Braun is relating to had to do with the 12b-7 part of their motion. That is the indispensable party part of American National's motion.
Mr. Trella, your time has expired, but I do have one question before you sit down.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your colleague suggested to us that Continental really had an opportunity to expand the record and really never did, and indeed never asked for reconsideration before the district court. And I thought you should have an opportunity to briefly answer that.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. First of all, a motion, a post-judgment motion or a motion for reconsideration isn't required to preserve issues for appeal. The district court had ruled, it had made a final decision. could we have filed a motion for reconsideration? Maybe. Were we required to? No, I don't think so. Furthermore, we had made clear our position in our reply in response to the first and only time apparent authority came up. We need discovery. We need a trial on this issue. The district court had deferred discovery. We could repeat our arguments, but there was nothing new that we could call to the district court's attention at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Treller.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Indeed, the court thanks both Mr. Treller and Mr. Braun for excellent briefs and excellent oral argument this morning, and the case will be taken under advisement.